Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today, Steve and I are continuing our celebration of the 40th anniversary of 1982's Blade Runner with part two of our discussion on the Blade Runner franchise. Now, we talked about the first film and the video game yesterday in part one, and if you haven't listened to that, then I recommend doing so before you listen to part two here today. Today, we're going to be talking about Blade Runner 2049 and the 13-episode anime series Blade Runner Black Lotus. But before we get into Blade Runner 2049, I believe you had something you wanted to say about the franchise, Steve.
Oh, sure. This series may not cover a lot of entries, but it makes up for that with sheer depth of meaning. Blade Runner is a concept that allows for many different ideas, including the very idea of what makes someone human or not. But more than that, I realized that Blade Runner is kind of the daredevil of science fiction franchises. There's no bad entry in any of it. Even the video game adaptation curse doesn't seem to stick to Blade Runner, as I think we've shown last time. And then it survives the modern sequel curse as well, as we'll talk about when we get into Blade Runner 2049. So why don't we start there, Mike?
All right. But before we get into the film, I would like to comment on what you said. This franchise does have two things that are common threads, and they are, number one, exactly what you hit upon, depth of meaning. I love it when a movie, or anything else for that matter, makes me think, and all of the Blade Runner franchise does that for me. The second common thread in the Blade Runner franchise is that it leans heavy on visual elements to tell the layered stories. Basically, if it's on the screen, and it's not happenstance, and you should take note of it, i.e. everything matters, from the sets to the books that are read. It all feeds into the story, character building, character and world building. Well, this can be said of all movies in general. I think Blade Runner's visual elements are part of what it's known for.
Oh, that's definitely true. Philip K. Dick, Ridley Scott, and Sid Mead created a visually interesting world, and the atmosphere establishes so much of what Blade Runner is. But so much of what you see in those films are these little visual touches, the symbolic elements that may seem small but add to the layers of meaning in the series. I'll also add that the world building gets really interesting in the series, especially after Denis Villeneuve starts adding to the history and the lore that the original film set up. So why don't we dive into that?
Sure. In October of 2017, 10 years after the final cut of the original film was released, we got a sequel called Blade Runner 2049. This second film in the franchise was directed by Denis Villeneuve and written by Hampton Fancher, who worked on the original film, and Michael Green. And it's funny how this keeps coming up, actually. Like the Matrix trilogy had the Animatrix to fill in the rest of the story through a series of shorts, Blade Runner 2049 was released alongside a trilogy of short prequel films that cover the 30 years between the two film settings of the original with 2019 and 2049. In my opinion, you really need to see those prequels if you want to get the whole story and understand everything that happens in the movie, as it totally sets the stage. And I actually think we should talk about those before we even get into the 2049 film itself. But before we jump into that, did you have any opening remarks on the film, Steve?
Oh, sure. I'll be honest. Before this movie came out, I had reservations about Blade Runner 2049. I really didn't know Denis Villeneuve as a director back in those days. And I wasn't convinced that Blade Runner needed a sequel. But I was also interested in what this movie was doing. The cast looked really good, and I hoped that this film would respect Ridley Scott's vision. But I was won over by 2049 the first time that I saw it. As the film went on, I got the feeling that Villeneuve knew how to make a science fiction film, and also that he wasn't going to completely run roughshod over the original Blade Runner. That isn't to say I agree with every single decision this film makes or that 2049 is flawless, but it was much better than I was expecting, and I liked a lot of what we ultimately got. It gave me enough faith in him that I supported the idea of him doing the Dune remake, which, by the way, I also really enjoyed. Go see it. He's a director that really seems to respect the classic science fiction franchises and can do them justice. Oh, and here's a fun fact. Ridley Scott was also planning to do Dune before he accepted Blade Runner, so he has a lot in common with Villeneuve.
Interesting coincidence. I mean, who would have thought? I actually liked Blade Runner 2049 right away, too. And for that matter, I love the new Dune movie. So I think we're on the same page there. But let's get into the prequel shorts from 2049. The first short is an anime called Blade Runner Blackout 2022 that takes place 3 years after the first film in 2022, obviously. The Tyrell Corporation in that year developed a new totally compliant Nexus 8 line of replicants, which function at a higher level and have a longer open-ended lifespan to replace the short-lived Nexus 6 models. This was necessary because the Nexus 6 models only lived for 4 years, and they were defiant and fought back. This bit is relevant as it comes up in the 2049 film. Having replicants with lifespans as long as humans caused a massive backlash among the human populace against the Nexus 8 models because they believed the replicants were actually a threat to their existence. Humans all over began hunting down and killing the new Nexus 8s. In my opinion, this had a very, I don't know, a second Renaissance Part 1 feel from the Animatrix to it. I mean, not an exact copy at all. That's not what I'm saying, but a similar idea.
That makes sense. I mean, it's not like Blade Runner was the first film to go there, so I totally get it. For those who might not be aware, Blackout 2022 was made by Shinichiro Watanabe, the creator of the original Cowboy Bebop anime, as opposed to the Netflix live-action show. This was huge. Even as someone who is not a huge anime fan, I respect Watanabe, especially when it comes to science fiction. This was a brilliant choice to do this short piece, and I really would like to see him do more Blade Runner one day. I do see what you're saying with the comparisons to Animatrix with Blackout, and indeed there are some parallels. I do feel like Blackout plays a bit differently, because it focuses more on a couple of central characters as they fight the system that has enslaved them. I wish we'd gotten more time with those characters, because I would have liked to have known them better before they sacrificed themselves. But still, what we get is pretty good. So do you want to get into what Blackout is about, Mike?
Sure, sure. You know, I really like those characters, too. They actually add to Sapper Morgan's story and really opened up the world of Rebel Replicants. But we'll get into that in just a few minutes. But yes, to what Blackout 2022 is about. While all of that crazy slaughtering of replicants and riots is going on, we meet a rogue replicant named Iggy. Iggy was an off-world soldier before he realized that the soldiers on both sides of the war were replicants, and he went AWOL. Iggy is now a freedom fighter for an underground replicant movement. This is interesting because in the film, Kay is a replicant tasked with killing other replicants, and he also switches sides, which means they're setting a precedent here with this, I think. But back to the short. At Iggy's side is a former pleasure model named Trixie. They didn't dig deep for that name. And they're on a mission to destroy the Tyrell Corporation's database of registered replicants, as well as the core internet server, so that the replicants can no longer be hunted. They arrange for a test nuclear warhead to be detonated above Los Angeles, and it happens, causing the namesake Blackout of 2022. However, while the mission was ultimately a success, Trixie is killed while battling security forces with Iggy. And now, this is the interesting part here. Well, I brought up the scene in part one of our discussion when we were talking about Roy from the original film. Trixie, too, saw the white dove in the sky as she died, a direct tie to the original film. Do you want to talk about that scene now? The Trixie scene with the dove wasn't done the same way as it was with Roy, you know, releasing the dub by hand. But do you think that's what they were going for there?
I think it's possible, and I have no doubt Watanabe was trying to make a nod to the original film. Blackout deals with the question of whether replicants have souls, and the brief conversation that Iggy has with Trixie on that question is interesting. Even though Iggy is convinced that they don't have souls, the end of the short seems to imply that he's wrong with the Dove reference. So I think you may be onto something there.
You know, I'm going to take that. But back to the finish of the Blackout 2022 story. Iggy manages to escape after Trixie's death and removes his right eye, which is, of course, the only thing that can identify him as a replicant, since all of the records are now wiped clean and Blade Runners can't use the information to track them anymore. The ending narration states that in the aftermath of the blackout and subsequent global collapse, that all replicant production and scientific activity was banned, and the Tyrell Corporation, along with nearly every other company for that matter, went bankrupt. But that would not be the end. The Wallace Corporation acquired the Tyrell Corporation and restarted production of the new model replicants a decade later with the Nexus 9s and Black Lotus. But again, we'll get into Black Lotus when we get to the anime series later on.
Yeah, I like that the 2049 era presents a very different world from Blade Runner in 2019. And they explain how the world gets there. I mean, some of what we see is a matter of plot convenience for 2049. I mean, they need a reason for why Kay just can't find everything in the computer records. It's a good way to bury all traces of the earlier replicants and make Kay rely on detective work. At the same time, I like the idea of replicant domestic terrorists making a huge impact on what the Blade Runner world becomes in 2049. It feels like a world that's evolving and that has real consequences and logical outcomes. Also, before we move on, I want to point out one thing of note. Sapper Morton, who is the Dave Bautista character that we see in the third short and who kills early in 2049, was involved in the blackout event. His identification is listed with the Nexus 6 models that are brought up on the computer files in Blackout. So he might seem like a minor character, but he's a character with some real impact on the world of 2049.
Oh, that is very true. Well, we'll get into that in a minute. I actually think there's even more to him than that. The next short was Blade Runner 2036 Nexus Dawn. That one is about Neander Wallace, the head of the Wallace Corporation, going to a hearing to discuss his desire to manufacture a new generation of replicants. This is a big ask because, as we know from the last short, replicants and their science were banned. Wallace points out that the Earth's ecosystem is collapsing and the only thing that will be able to sustain the human race is cheap labor provided by replicants. He also claims that the new replicants, the Nexus 9 models, are both compliant and not dangerous to humans. To prove this, he has one of his newly developed Nexus 9s cut himself and then tells the replicant to choose between his own life and Wallace's. In response, the Nexus 9 replicant then cuts his own throat and falls to the floor dead. Wallace then asks again if they're willing to authorize the production of the new replicants. All casually and cold, I might add. This scene was intense, and it was made all the more so by Blade Runner Black Lotus. But again, we'll get into that later.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Now, I really love this short, I must admit. Jared Leto tends to take some flack for his performances as Joker and as Morbius, but I think Neander Wallace is honestly one of his best characters. He pulls off the blindness very well, and he has this cold, controlled way of speaking that makes him memorable. He's also written very well. I mean, he's a visionary with a god complex, seeing himself as a creator of angels. Leto is chilling as Wallace in this short, and even though he's their creator, he has no problems in killing any of them as long as he achieves his goals. I think he's a really great villain, and Nexus Dawn gives you a glimpse as to why he's so interesting and even frightening.
Well said. I agree with all of that. In fact, I'm going to expound on exactly that when we get into the Blade Runner Black Lotus discussion. As you mentioned before, the last short is Blade Runner 2049, Nowhere to Run, about Dave Bautista's character in 2049, Sapper Morton. He seems like a normal guy struggling to make ends meet as what appears to be some kind of worm farmer. And that's key element because these worms are now Neander Wallace Jr. Solved the world hunger crisis. How exactly, I'm not sure, but these worms are tied into how they made food. Another key element about Sapper Morgan is how he goes out of his way, by implication often, to visit a homeless girl named Elle and her mother. In short, we see him going to do just that in the short, sorry. We go see him doing just that. On the way, Sapper ignores several threats and some harassment from thugs on the street, which shows he was not willing to fight without good reason. And if he could just, if he could walk away, he would. In this visit to see Elle in the short, Sapper brings her a book he really enjoyed called The Power and the Glory, which is about an unnamed whiskey priest who combines a great power for self-destruction with pitiful cravenness and almost painful penitence, and a desperate quest for dignity. But by the end of the story, though, the priest acquires a real holiness. I find it interesting that Sapper liked this book. You know, he's a big, strong body. But he has very humble nature and kind eyes. I think maybe the book was meant to say that he had a broken past too. But like the whiskey priest, he eventually found his way. My guess is that this happened when he witnessed the miracle of replicant birth. I believe he spoke of to Kay in 2049.
You're onto something there, I think. Sapper definitely alludes to this in his last conversation with Kay in the beginning of 2049. He says that Kay has never seen a miracle, and that's why he's basically lost in doing the bidding of his creators. This eventually turns out to be true. Later on, what we see is that Sapper's death is a knowing act of sacrifice, which is something that a true believer in a cause would do. We see quite a few times that replicants are able to stop being killers and embrace a higher purpose, as Sapper clearly does between the blackout and his death in 2049. He's a killer who found God.
That is a great way of putting that. And the correlations between spiritual conversion by faith and Sapper Morgan's story really fit together very nicely. It's kind of beautiful, really.
It is. It's tragic in a sense, too, but Sapper makes the most of his life he's given, and there is beauty in that. So let's dive a bit into where Sapper ends up.
All right. But back into the story of Blade Runner 2048 and Nowhere to Run. We see that Sapper is willing to fight when thugs threaten Ella and her mother, where he was not willing to fight earlier when there was a threat actually against him. In fact, he's willing to kill to protect Elle and her mother. During the fight, Sapper is revealed as a replicant by an onlooker who witnesses great strength and calls in his location, which is how Kay actually finds him in the beginning of 2049.
Yeah, that makes sense. Before I really get into Nowhere to Run, though, I want to say that I finally figured out why the Sapper Morgan we see there seems a bit different than the one at the start of Blade Runner 2049. I think when he wrote 2049, Hampton Fancher recycled a scene from an early draft of the original Blade Runner that he wanted to bring back. In the Dangerous Days documentary, we see storyboards of the original opening scene of the first Blade Runner, and they are exactly the same as the opening with Morden from 2049, shot for shot. Nowhere to One expands on this character quite a bit, and I think it makes a huge difference.
I caught that, too. Those two scenes are very similar. But in our poring over of movies, I found that there's a lot of using what's left over from one film to put in the sequel going on in Hollywood. As to your second point, I watched the film first and then the prequel shorts afterwards. And in that order, I didn't think much of Sapper at first either. But man, does that prequel short speak volumes.
Oh, it really does. Beyond being played by Dave Bautista, Sapper Morgan didn't make a huge impression on me when I first saw him in 2049. I mean, he seemed like what Kowalski was in the original film, a minor character who's a physical threat for the Blade Runner to retire. Realizing that it's essentially a rewrite of the opening scene from a previous draft for the first film, that adds up. But with what we learn about him in the shorts, I have to reevaluate my opinion of Morden. I think Morden is exactly the kind of character as the whiskey priest from the book, which is why I think The Power and the Glory is a favorite book of his. He's done things he's not proud of, and it's true that he was involved with the blackout. I think he has regrets about that. Maybe he even feels guilt for surviving when his comrades like Iggy and Trixie all died. I think this may be why Morden decides to reveal himself to save the girl. He's tired of running on some level, and he's ready to deal with the consequences of his past. So by the time Kate catches up with him, he's accepting of his fate, even if he's willing to fight for his life if he has to. We learn later from the replicant leader, Freysa, that Morden gives his life for the larger cause. This short goes a long way in explaining Morden's character, and it makes you feel sympathy for him after he meets his end. But why don't we get into what happens in 2049, Mike?
Sure, Steve. A basic summary of the plot for Blade Runner 2049 would go like this. 30 years after the original film, which took place in 2019, the powerful Tyrell Corporation is now under the control of the darkly idealistic scientist Neander Wallace Jr. Wallace has single-handedly revived the replicant industry with his new and improved bioengineered replicants, the Nexus Nines, which, as we saw in Blade Runner 2036 Nexus Dawn, have none of the non-compliance flaws of the Nexus 8 models we saw in Blade Runner Blackout 2022. These new Nexus 9s seem to have integrated seamlessly into society by 2049 and perform a variety of tasks, typically just those that aren't desired by humans. Enter a new replicant, Blade Runner, LAPD's officer KD6-3.7, aka K. K's job is to eradicate the outdated and rebellious Nexus 8 models. And while on a standard assignment, K unearths a long-buried and well-hidden secret about Tyrell's last gift to the replicant industry, the ability to reproduce. This knowledge has the potential to plunge what's left of society into chaos by shattering the wall of deception that divides civility and anarchy. K is ordered to destroy the evidence and rebury the secret, but K's discovery leads him on a quest to find Rick Deckard, a former LAPD Blade Runner who's been missing since 2019 when he disappeared with Rachel.
Yeah, that covers the basic plot pretty thoroughly. Once again, we're dealing with a very noir detective setup, with a Blade Runner having to go out and retire replicants while solving a mystery. Where I think it adds to the formula, though, is that the mystery is the story of what happened between the two films, and especially what happened to Deckard and Rachel. The other thing that comes into play is that Kay is both a Blade Runner and a new model replicant, which is an interesting choice from a main character. He is a replicant, and he knows it, or at least he thinks he does. But then his whole identity is thrown into question, which is a common element we see in the series. I feel like this movie does a good job of playing with the foundational elements of Blade Runner while giving us something different.
It really does. I love the idea of reproduction being added by Tyrell and Wallace, and I was really hoping that Kay was Deckard and Rachel's kid. Again, the Blade Runner franchise gives us a new way to explore what life is and how it's defined, and I think Philip Dick would have liked that a lot with how you described his book before in part one. But speaking of new ways to define life, I gotta say that I am again reminded of Star Trek in Blade Runner 2049's exploration of the meaning of sentience, the human experience, and even what it takes to have a soul. But this time it's Star Trek Voyager and the emergency medical hologram, aka the Doctor. The Doctor grew more and more complex with various subroutines and experience, and while it took a god-awful amount of memory to store, he became like a real person and was treated as such by the crew. Now compare this to Kay and Joy's relationship in 2049. I think they take that a step further in the film. Kay pondered the qualifications of having a soul and treated his holographic wife Joy like a real person. In fact, Joy was an app designed to be whatever fantasy you wanted, and Kay chose to make her essentially a 50s TV show wife. But what Kay thought was actually how it worked, I imagine. He wanted a human relationship and a normal wife, but Joy seemed to become even more than that, at least in some ways. She genuinely wanted to go outside. She talked about having cabin fever and was joyous to be standing in the rain. Later on, she honestly wanted to protect Kay and go with him when he was in trouble. What's more is that despite Kay being a replicant and Joy being a hologram, we see them having what are clearly very human moments together. This, I think, brings to question what actually defines a human experience. If you ask me, a human experience is also clearly what Sapper Morton experienced when he explained that Kay didn't understand because he had never witnessed a miracle. As I mentioned before, in my opinion, Sapper was making a reference to Rachel giving birth and that experience, that miracle changed him forever. Having a life-changing moment sounds very human to me.
Oh, yeah, and I totally agree about Joy and Kay's relationship. It's so touching. Sapper seems like such a walk-on character when you first meet him in this film, but once you've seen everything and really stop to think about his character, the more interesting he gets. Sapper starts off as a combat replicant, becomes a terrorist, and then gradually starts to appreciate life to the point where he's willing to die to protect it. He's not unlike Roy Boddy in a way. It's a complete character arc, but we barely see it.
Totally, totally. They give you all the pieces, but you can't. You really kind of have to put it together yourself to see the picture on top.
Oh, for sure. Anyway, to address your points on Joy, she's an interesting character, and I felt that from the beginning, like the movie was using her to make a point. This was my first exposure to Ana de Armas, and she's very good at as the Joy hologram. But I like the idea that Joy is almost a reflection of how Kay sees her. She gives you what you want to believe and becomes whatever that is. She tells you what you want to hear, and she makes you want to believe things about yourself that aren't necessarily true. At the same time, though, I feel like Joy, or at least the model that Kay has, did really care about Kay beyond being his personal assistant. I don't feel like Joy ever misleads anyone with malicious intent or anything like that. I think she just wants to make Kay happy. But she just sometimes does this by spreading untrue ideas. I honestly felt bad for Kay when Joy was destroyed by Wallace's goons. But at the same time, I also saw why it was necessary. For Kay to grow and understand himself, he needs to be stripped of the illusions and the false beliefs that Joy gives him. It's happiness built on a lie, however well-meant that lie is. The lie has to be destroyed for Kay to reach true self-understanding, however beautiful and joyous that lie might be.
I felt bad for Kay then, too. Joy was his one, just that one special part of his life, his one real source of peace, and they took her from him, lie or not, like she was nothing. You know, they say beauty is in the eye of beholder, and that's certainly what Joy was to Kay.
Oh, exactly. One other thing that reinforces the point is the brief reference to Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov, which is a book that Joy tries to get Kay to read. I have not read this book, but it dives into a lot of these themes as well. One of the characters in the novel is a man who believes that he's the exiled king of a country called Zembla, only to find out that the king and the country don't even exist. They're all delusions that he's convinced himself of, but they're not real. Kay similarly holds a false belief that he's special, only for those hopes to be dashed by a cold splash of reality later on.
You really have to pay attention to the books that are referenced in Blade Runner franchise. I did not pick up on that reference, but that is a nice catch, and it really paints a picture, like you're saying. As people, and even as replicants, apparently, we carefully build our existential paradigm and worldview. You know, no brick is laid that isn't there for a reason, even if the reason only makes sense to us. That is how we cope. That's how we manage. So when something comes along and shows us what we built as a lie, that is hard to accept. So I fully felt for Kay when he lost his security blanket. I think most adults can relate with how that feels. That's one of the things that makes the philosophical discussion of the film so meaningful, and it touches back to that human experience bit we talked about earlier. I think these things are put in there specifically to depict human experience. Being able to accept a known lie because it hurts less than the truth. I don't know about you, but I've certainly been there.
It is definitely a relatable experience, and I totally understood how you felt about wanting Kay to be the son of Deckard and Rachel. I wanted that, too, on my first viewing, but the truth is a lot more complicated than that, as Kay eventually finds out. Even if he's not part human, he does have part of Deckard's real daughter inside of him, which is the memories that she designed for him that were hers. So there is a little bit of Deckard in him, just not the way he imagined or wanted to believe was true. Sometimes the life pulls the rug from you, and then reality ends up being less simplistic than we imagine or want it to be in the end. Kay's story is about his acceptance of the complexity of life, I think.
You know, I actually hadn't thought about it like that, but that does make me feel a little better about it.
Yeah, and I'll also add that in retrospect, I think Joy was the one who was feeding Wallace information and how he knows everything he does. I was wondering for a while how Wallace knew about the child's existence when only two people had any idea about her at all, and that was the police chief and Kay. But if Joy is the leak and Wallace is using her to spy on Kay, that would make some sense. I don't think Joy does so consciously, and I don't think that Joy would ever intentionally betray Kay. I mean, she risks his own existence to save him. But it's clear that Wallace has some kind of a backdoor access to her because he's the one who designed her. I think that this is partly the reason Joy tells Kay to delete her from the house when they leave. She's also defying her programming just as much as Kay is.
I'm behind you 100% on that one, especially in light of Black Lotus. That is exactly how Neander Wallace Jr. would do that. In fact, I would not be surprised if all Holo apps were actually a type of surveillance under the guise of entertainment. It feeds into Neander's god complex, so that perfectly makes sense to me, and really has to be the answer, I think. And speaking of how people get their information, I can't help but notice that Gaff is up to his old tricks in Blade Runner 2049. He kept making the unicorns in the original film because he knew Deckard had Tyrell's niece's dream about the unicorn, or as you suggested, maybe even Tyrell's dream. But in this one, we find out that Kay's memory of hiding the wooden horse from the bullies was a real memory, from an actual lived experience, even if it wasn't actually his. The memory was implanted from Deckard's daughter, Dr. Anna Staline's, life. But somehow, Gaff knew about that implant, too. When Kay went to go visit him, he made that origami horse. This seems to imply that Gaff knew Dr. Anna Staline's memories, too, like he knew Tyrell's niece's memory, or even Tyrell's, like you suggested in part one.
That's entirely plausible. Gaff continues to be an important background figure here, just as he was in both the original Blade Runner and even to a lesser extent in the game. So it's nice to see him again here. The wooden horse is the perfect symbol because it represents a Trojan horse. It is a mental trap that Kay falls prey to, and it leads him astray. Also, a Trojan horse in computer terms is a form of malware that can corrupt programming. So the horse in Kay's memory is a Trojan horse that undermines Kay's programming and conditioning. As for Gaff, he always seems to know more than he's saying as well, and he always adds to the symbolism with his origami figures.
I can totally see that as a Trojan horse symbol. It certainly works that way. But as far as Gaff goes, I mean, I guess we're just supposed to infer from all these implications that Gaff is like a Batman-level detective and he just knows everything, seeing how they don't provide a reason for Gaff's knowledge in the first or second film and leave us to put it together ourselves. I honestly don't know how else to see that.
Well, Gaff is a skilled detective. I mean, he worked in the Blade Runner unit and he knew all the players involved. I mean, that gives him a leg up on just about everyone in this film. He probably kept track of Deckard, Rachel, and their daughter over the years for his own reasons. I mean, we know that he was protecting Deckard and Rachel when they left the city originally, so he might still be looking out for them in his own way. We also find out where the horse came from. I mean, we see similar figures in Deckard's place, so we can assume that Deckard gave it to her and that Gaff would know that. If Gaff is keeping tabs on Deckard, then he would have ways of knowing about the horse. Still, it's true that we're being asked to do the work of the movie on this one.
I can accept that. That's certainly a more well-thought-out reason than I had, and Gaff keeping tabs on them does seem to make everything fall into place nicely. And actually, speaking of Deckard's daughter, I also found it interesting that Dr. Anna Staline said that people think remembering is about the details, but it's not. She says we remember with our feelings. Now, this is particularly interesting because Kay is totally emotionless in the film until he finds out that the memory about the wooden horse being real, and that he might even have been born, and that by his own definition, he might actually have a soul. Up until that point, even when you can tell Kay didn't like what someone said, there was no emotional response. As an example, I would bring up when Lieutenant Joshi told Kay that he has gotten along just fine without a soul. You can tell that Kay didn't like her saying that and that he's contemplating what all she was saying, but there was no emotion, which is a huge credit to Gosling, I might add. Then later, as Kay is trying to take in what all it could mean if he has a soul, Joy keeps insisting that Kay should take the name Joe specifically. I'm guessing that's a play on her own name, that he is more than a serial name, and that Kay has when she does that, Kay has his first emotional response in the movie. He raises his voice to tell Joy to stop. Then again, when Kay finds out his memory is real from Dr. Anna Staline, he puts his face in his hands, he rubs his forehead. You can hear in his panicked breath that he's basically having a panic attack. What's more is that he acted out in frustration by screaming out and kicking his chair. All of this connected to a memory which he remembered with his feelings, and they were awakened in him. Despite not being born like he thought he was, I believe Kay is special and different from the other Nexus 9s.
That totally makes sense. Kay is an advanced model and probably one of Wallace's top-of-the-line replicants. I also agree that Gosling is very good in this role. there's an innocence to him as much as he gets across the soullessness of his early scenes as Kay. But then he finds the human part of himself, the piece that Anna gave him, and he becomes more than just a soulless killing machine. Joy refers to him as a real boy, making reference to Kay as Pinocchio, as he gradually becomes more human in his outlook. Now, with Kay, it seems to me that the police department recognizes the risk of even a new model replicant possibly going rogue. They keep making Kay take these psychological tests to make sure that he's acting within baseline parameters. They're trying to provoke an emotional response to make sure that he's in compliance. It's almost like the opposite of the Void Comp test, with the idea that they want Kay to act more like a true replicant and not like a person. At the same time, the Chief does occasionally treat him almost in a human-like way, except for when she sends him out to carry some pretty dark orders. So I'm guessing that Wallace didn't completely eliminate all emotion or independent thought, and it is possible to break that conditioning under the right conditions. He probably just developed a way to make them obey, but it's not necessarily a foolproof method. The memory implant seems to be a double-edged sword in the replicant design. They make them more human-like, but those memories can also make them more independent. I don't even think Wallace has been able to solve that problem completely yet.
I honestly think the flaw is actually in humans rather than the technology. Humans in Blade Runner have conflicting desires about what they even want from replicants. Replicants are intended as a slave workforce that excuses having them as slaves because they're just machines. We don't talk about toasters or microwaves like they're slaves. We view them as tools, and that is how people wanted to view replicants. But with great contradiction, they also wanted their humanoid slaves to act more human and less like just tools, which makes them feel more comfortable. But even that comfort is a contradiction to the comfort they already wanted by making them acceptable slaves.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think this is probably the blind spot in Wallace's thinking and how replicants start to break his conditioning. I mean, he can anticipate systems and technology very well, but his foresight starts to elude him when it comes to the human factor. When you make replicants that are more human than human, they become harder for him to control. It's a mistake he makes with L in Black Lotus and then again with K.
Yeah, sometimes we just get in our own way. But if we could circle back to our discussion about K being special... I also think that Love, Wallace's enforcer replicant, is special. Kay himself noted that Love must be special since Wallace named her. But Love has strong and conflicting feelings about Wallace, a twisted father-husband kind of relationship, and she doesn't know how to process it all. And honestly, who could? That's one confusing freaking relationship dynamic. But one thing is for certain, she is very loyal to Wallace and desperately wishes to impress him. She wants to be the best for him and all that he wants her to be and more. Jared Leto jokingly said this in about the Love character. He said, "It's hard to rely on people, but you can always rely on love," with this kind of evil little smirk. It was funny, but but I did notice this about Love. She asked Kay if he enjoyed his job, and I think because she certainly gets off on hers. When they interviewed Sylvia Hoax, who played Love, she said that they decided Love was only 12 years old and that she was not given an emotional cushion with memories like other replicants. So the palette she's working with kind of goes haywire because she is, in fact, only 12 years old in her understanding. That's why we get the cold, brutal violence from her. She's a kid with superpowers that didn't have a proper mentor, basically.
That completely adds up. Love probably is special, yes, though I don't think she's just blindly following her programming. I mean, she seems to enjoy her acts of brutality way too much to be a completely emotionless automaton. At the same time, she seems to be what Wallace designed her to be, and that's probably why Wallace trusts her to deal with his dirty work. She does definitely seem to want Wallace's approval, and I agree that that's a pretty twisted relationship. She seems to buy into a lot of Wallace's ideology, and she's a true believer in Wallace's cult of personality. She believes in the supremacy of replicants, and she sees herself as a cut above even the rest of her kind. But that's not the only screwed-up relationship he has, she has. One thing I realized on my last watch of this film is that Love has a weird love-hate relationship with Kay. And I think I can understand why she feels this way towards him. Some of it is a form of professional rivalry, with Love trying to prove she's the superior model and maybe the superior killer. But I think she also realizes that in many ways they're the same. They're both replicants designed to kill with absolute unquestioning obedience, and they're both very good at it. I think Love is drawn to Kay because she sees him as a kindred spirit and she enjoys their fights out of this weird mix of sex and violence. At the end, she kisses Kay before she tries to kill him, which I think is telling. But I think she also hates that Kay chooses to embrace humanity instead of his superior nature as a replicant. She's attracted to the violence and repulsed by Kay's desire to be human.
You know, I think you hit on something there. Wallace believes that humans are flawed, and his desire and plan is to replace humanity with his own replicant children. As you mentioned, Love is a true believer in Wallace's ideology, and her hating Kay's human side probably stems from that.
Oh, likely, yes. I'll also add that I think this is why Love destroys Joy at Deckard's place. Partly it's out of sadism and a desire to hurt and break Kay. She might also be doing it because she thinks Joy makes Kay weaker by infecting him with these dreams of humanity. But I think Love also realizes at that moment that Joy is also a rival, and Love brutally crushes her to eliminate the competition. It's also a point that she's making to Kay, that she's a superior model and nothing and no one comes before her.
I think that also calls back to Love essentially being a child. At least in my eyes, that stuff seems like immaturity. And maturity is something else that implanted memories apparently provide, and she is a clean slate.
Oh, absolutely. I never really thought about that angle, but given what the actress has said about Love, that explains a lot.
All right. So, random question. Is the snow significant somehow? I noticed Deckard was seeing the snow when everybody else was seeing rain after he shot that replicant, you know, and she fell through the window and everything. Then as Kay is awakening to the truth in 2049, we see snow again, or rather, Kay almost seems to be noticing it himself.
That's an interesting question. I seem to remember Denis Villeneuve saying somewhere, and it might have been in the director's commentary, that the snow in this film was an artistic choice on his part. Partly it was a desire to make 2049 visually different from Ridley Scott's film. Partially it's because Villeneuve is from Quebec and he was drawing on his own experiences living there. Some of it was the climate change caused by the blackout and the previous nuclear war from before the first film. Now, I don't remember any specific symbolic meaning he gave for those instances though. Snow tends to represent purity and innocence, so maybe it's related to that in some way. Perhaps it's a form of rebirth, in a sense, as Kay begins his new life with a new purpose. The other possible interpretation is that snowflakes are unique, and the snow represents Kay's discovery of his own individuality. But, I mean, only Denis Villeneuve would know for sure.
I can see what you're saying. I guess I'm adding another level to it from the theatrical cut of Blade Runner. You know, in the voiceover, Deckard talks about how he could never just gun down a woman. But in that scene where he shoots the female replicant down as she crashes through the windows, it's like he suddenly realized that he had, in fact, just gunned down a woman and not just a machine. And that's when we get the snow in the original Blade Runner for the first time, and not rain. I find it interesting, too, that he saw it and not the other people. Combine that with the symbolism for snow that you were just talking about it, and I see an even deeper meaning there. But I suppose you're right in that only the directors probably know the answer to that. But we'd love to hear from our listeners on this one. Do you think there's a correlation with the snow in these two films like I'm suggesting, or is it just aesthetics? For our Anchor and Spotify listeners, there's a poll attached to this episode for you to let us know what you think. And for our Patreon listeners, please leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. So that about wraps up our Blade Runner 2049 discussion, and that leaves Blade Runner Black Lotus, which is quite a bit to unpack as well. Blade Runner Black Lotus is a Japanese-American CGI anime TV series set in 2032 Los Angeles, 10 years after the events of Blade Runner Blackout 2022. The series ran for 13 episodes from November 2021 to February 2022. While Blade Runner Black Lotus primarily follows the replicant named L, aka Black Lotus, the series also focuses on the origin story for Neander Wallace Jr., the villain from Blade Runner 2049, and how L played an important role in facilitating his rise to power and even leaving him blind like we find him in 2049. The last focus of the series seems to be giving us the last pieces of the puzzle from the prequel shorts we got from 2049. With those pieces, we have a clear idea about the 30 years between 2019 and 2049.
Yeah, this series feels in a very logical place between the two films, so I'm glad that they did it. The story of how Neander Wallace Jr. rises to power and loses his eyes is worth doing. and tying it into a new replicant character is a good way to do it. We also see appearances by other recognizable characters, most notably Doc Badger from 2049. Also, I admit to liking Elle decently well as a character, and her backstory is compelling.
I have to agree with you. I really like the no-nonsense Doc Badger character. He has both a high IQ and street smarts, and he tells it to you straight. I like that about a character, and the actor really does his personality well. I also like Elle a lot, too, but I have to admit I was leery about watching the series because I'm not a huge fan of some of the artwork I've seen in other anime films. I can almost get into them, really, because a lot of them have good stories and stuff, but then I see that what I call these cheesy, emotionally exaggerated faces and giant anime eyes of the characters, it just takes me out of it. But it would seem that what classifies as anime has evolved. Going by this series alone, I would even say that I like Japanese-American CGI stuff. I think the creative team, Crunchyroll, Adult Swim, and Alcon Television Group did a great job on the look and feel of the series. It totally feels like Blade Runner LA. I thought the fight choreography was done well, and props to the writers too. There were actually several writers, including Eugene Sun, who wrote 6 of the 13 episodes, Alex DeCampi, Brandon Amon, Kenji Kamiyama, and Margaret Dunlap. Great episodes, great series, great story. Also, I thought the music for the series was really good. It's not my usual kind of music, but I liked it. I particularly like that Last Goodbye Blues number in episode 10.
Oh, that was a really good number, even if it was a bittersweet moment. But I think we agree on Black Lotus as a whole. Even though this series has anime elements and it was made by creators with anime experience, the visual style is more accessible to a Western audience than Blackout was. What we see here is a bit more reminiscent of Star Wars The Clone Wars than any kind of a traditional anime show. The music wasn't quite the Vangelis score, but and R.I.P. Vangelis. But it had the right somber tone for the series.
Well, see, there I was thinking I'd finally found another anime film I liked. But seriously, it was a lot more like the Clone Wars series, you're right. And it did make it more accessible to me, so guilty as charged there. But let's get into the series. I have some things I noticed going through these that I'm just dying to talk with you about. So, in episode 3, The Human Condition, the junkyard owner Joseph, who already knows Elle is a replicant, looks in Elle's left eye and deduces that if she was a Nexus 6, she'd already be dead by now since it's 2032. He also says that if she was a Nexus 8, she would have a serial number on her eye, and she doesn't, so she's not a replicant. But despite that, Joseph is about to give Elle the Voight Comp test, and Elle's worried that it might not work because she doesn't have any memories, which isn't exactly true. If she is a replicant, then it's important to note that she lied right there. But Joseph tells her that feelings can tell more about memories because they're deeper, which echoes with Dr. Anna Staline's words and Kay's emotional response to his memory. Tyrell talked about an emotional cushion for Rachel. I can't help but feel that there's a message here about emotion and memory that I'm not quite putting my finger on. Also, are we supposed to assume that convincing her she was human was part of Neander Jr.'s directives to him? I mean, why else would he put on the charade?
Yeah, I think being part it probably was. Now, memory figures very prominently into the idea of identity and how we construct ourselves. Memory can also provoke emotional responses. So ultimately, you could see memory as how we define ourselves. Elle starts off without any memory, doesn't know who she is or what her place in the world is, and she's effectively a blank slate. The other side is that the memory implants help to create definition and even programming, as we've seen in the case of Kay. So the memories make the replicants more human than human, but they also serve to define roles and functions for each replicant. I think we're seeing at least some of that play out in Elle's case as well.
I like how you said that. Our memories ultimately are ultimately how we define ourselves. That is so true, and it plays back to Roy Batty's comment about all that he had seen and done. Essentially, who he was would disappear like tears in the rain. You know, without our memories and our emotions about them, we lose all definition. We come a void, like how Elle felt wandering to a place she didn't know and wondering who she was. You know, in episode 3, we see a crap ton of symbolism being shown in the visuals, and the dialogue provides the commentary on it. In the scene, we see a young Neander Wallace Jr. debating with his father whether it was his research and ideas or his father's money that saved the people of Earth. While this is happening, the two of them are playing an ancient Chinese board game, Wei Qi, or Go, as they call it in the film. And Neander Jr. flips through a book from the 5th century called The City of God. All three of these things going on the scene are talking about the same things and informing one another, which means there's a whole lot to unpack in this context. But first, I want to talk about the Go board game. Each player, first black, the color Wallace Sr. is playing, and then white, played by Neander Jr., takes turns placing a stone on the intersections of the board one at a time. There's a couple of things to note here. The most obvious is that Wallace Sr. playing black went first by establishing his position on the board, i.e. building the Wallace Corporation empire, while Neander Jr. came afterwards with his research and ideas. But the second thing is about the book Neander Jr. is reading, The City of God, and the symbolism of the colors of their stones that is implied by combining these elements. The color white often represents what is good, while the color black often represents evil. And I think that's what they're going for here. The reason is that the City of God is essentially St. Augustine's rebuttal against claims that Christianity was what brought down the fall of Rome. That's interesting, too, as Wallace Sr. later suggests that Neander Jr.'s experimental replicants are going to be the end of the Wallace Corporation because of the doll hunt and the body count that Elle is racking up.
That's a really good take there. The game that the Wallaces are playing is representative of a larger power play that Junior is playing against Senior. It's very much a chess game being played between them. I mean, even if it's technically Go that they're playing. I like that each side matches up to each player's dress and hair color. Senior is white-haired and always wearing white, while Junior is dark-haired and always wearing black. They are the kings of their respective sides in the game, using everyone around them as pawns to achieve their larger goals. Senior is trying to protect himself and his position of power, while Junior has a larger vision of what he wants to accomplish with the replicants and the company. The replicants are little more than sacrificial pawns to be played in their game for power over Wallace Corp. But to play it more symbolically, you could see Junior as Satan trying to usurp the throne of God, who here is his literal father. But I know theology is more in your wheelhouse, so would you like to expand on that a bit, Mike?
I do. St. Augustine's thesis, The City of God, depicts the history of the world as one giant universe-spanning war between the good God, as Neander Jr. sees himself playing the white Go stones in the first scene, and the evil devil, as Neander sees his father, who's playing the black Go stones in the first scene. In the universal war between these two forces that St. Augustine describes, God is moving governments, political and ideological movements, and military forces aligned most with the Catholic Church, i.e. the City of God, by divine intervention to oppose those governments, political and ideological movements, and military forces most aligned with the devil, i.e. the city of the world or man, by all means, just like placing stones on the Go board. This is, of course, akin to Neander Jr. having to plot against his own father, or the city of world man with L. It also speaks of Neander Jr.'s need to get their government to lift the ban on creating replicants and intervening to bring it all about. So in this case, the city of God or the city of the world or man, aka evil, is both Neander's father and the government. While all of this is going on, Wallace Sr. asserts that it was his company and his money that accomplished everything, and young Neander says that it was he who gave manna to the people when heaven could not provide. This is, of course, a reference to the Israelites being fed in the desert and to Neander Jr. solving the world hunger crisis. Neander Jr. goes on to say that a man capable of a feat of such enormity only needs time and not wealth to accomplish his goal. His father argued that Neander needed his money to lift the ban on replicants. Neander simply says that everything intended will happen. A God wills it so, which is really creepy. Remember I said that. Neander, considering Neander was reading The City of God when he said this, I find that interesting. If you follow me here, I think young Neander sees himself as God and that his divine intervention will bring about his ends and not those laws or governments prohibiting his Nexus models. A God wills it so. What's more, Neander Jr. even refers to his father as a minor deity, Saturn, eating his children. While Neander referenced Saturn, the minor deity reference about his father certainly fits the devil description. I also think this speaks of their relationship, his father's betrayal of using the doll hunt to get rid of his new replicants. But it goes deeper than that and implies that Neander believes himself to be the superior god. I find it interesting that Jared Leto, who played Neander Jr. in 2049, said that he doesn't see Neander Jr.'s ego as too far off, considering that he literally saved the world. Leto even adds that we've seen men with bigger egos do far less. But back to Neander Jr. and Black Lotus. Jr. gives a whole speech later on about how the world that was made before by God is flawed, as are his creation. Neander says in episode 10 that he wanted to make a new world full of his creations, just like God. And I think Neander Wallace Sr., who seems to have read The City of God too, heard that bold claim of divinity in what his son said and implied too. I say this because he even asked Neander Jr. if he knows who he sounds like while the screen is directly on The City of God book. I think this is Wallace Sr. referring to Lucifer wanting to be like God, meaning Wallace Sr. believes Neander to be the devil or the city of the world or man. This paints an eerie prequel short, Blade Runner 2036 Nexus Dawn, just 5 years later, in even darker, more sinister color as we see the fruition of God Neander's intention.
Oh, wow. That's a really thorough dissection of that relationship. So much so that I don't know if I can add too much else to it. I mean, the younger Neander Wallace wants to take his place as God and creator. I mean, he sees the replicants as angels. You could then maybe see Black Lotus as a fallen angel who rebels against her creator as well. In 2049, Wallace mentions that he used to make bad angels, but I make good angels now. I think Black Lotus is one of the bad angels he was referring to, but we'll get into that a little bit more once we get into Wallace Jr. and his real plan. Now, the Saturn eating his children line was a really interesting point because it opens parallel into Greek myth. Saturn, or Kronos in the Greek version, eats his children for similar reason that Senior kills the replicants, to protect his position of power because he feels he's being threatened by the existence of his children. And what happens to Kronos by the end? Well, his son Zeus is hidden from him until he overthrows Kronos, and then Zeus ascends to the throne of Olympus. You could see Neander Jr. is playing the role of Zeus as he overthrows his father, and Zeus also is a father of gods, much as Jr. sees himself. So Neander Jr. Is Zeus, usurping the throne of Olympus from a father who knows his time is nearing its end.
You know, I hadn't picked up on that connection, and honestly, I don't know how I missed it. That's a nice catch, Steve. Neander Jr. is totally Zeus in that scenario, and you could even take it further and add that Zeus also created man, like Neander Jr. spoke of doing with his replicants. But this game on many levels that Neander is playing with Wallace Sr. comes to an end in Episode 9. Neander Jr.'s plan is unfolding perfectly, as he said. A god wills it so. Everyone from the doll hunt is dead, including Dr. M, and now L is after Wallace Sr. It seems that all the cards are on the table here, and there are no more moves left, and Neander Jr.'s last statement and go stone placement, which is black this time instead of white. Meaning, I think that Neander sees himself differently as a villain in that final game there that they were playing. Neander Jr. tells his father that there is no need to bring all this to an end, as his father demanded, since things are already at an end. And with that, Neander Jr. places the last stone on the go board and walks away, knowing that he has won the score. And that's interesting. One thing you need to know about the go game is that the game ends when both players, believing nothing more can be accomplished with further play, then end the game, and it's scored to determine the winner.
Yeah, and that last black stone is L. The first time I went through the series, I was pretty sure that Neander Jr. was using L as a pawn to kill his father and usurp control over Wallace Corp. I also felt certain that the hooded figure from L's memory was Neander Jr., and that he had programmed her to rebel and kill the people responsible for the doll hunt. Jr. hated the doll hunt because he felt that killing them was a waste of the replicant's potential, so I wouldn't have put it past him to sabotage the hunt. But I think it was pretty obvious that the whole thing was an inside job, when Elle was getting able to get into Senior's penthouse room with all the security. And at that point, it became clear that Elle was a sacrificial pawn the entire time, that she was a specially designed assassin made to kill Neander Sr. and his political allies. It's honestly a brilliant plan by Junior, and one that I think elevates him to magnificent bastard levels of villainy.
You're right on all fronts there, especially about Elle having access to Wallace Sr.'s fortress of a penthouse, because she had Neander Jr.'s DNA, or at least, I mean, his handprint or something on episode 9. I got the impression it was DNA, but I guess we don't actually know. But she was clearly designed with a specific purpose, despite Wallace Sr.'s efforts. In episode 7, Reality, we find out that Elle is a new type of replicant than we've had before. Besides being made specifically for the Dull Hunt, which already makes her unique in at least programming from the other replicants. But we find out that Dr. M that Elle is a deviant, which I'm guessing has something to do with her eyes glowing red occasionally and her ability to fight when she could not before. What's more is Detective Alani Davis points out in episode 8 that a normal replicant would not have stood a chance against a Blade Runner. But Black Lotus, a.k.a. Elle, is no ordinary replicant. Elle not only fought Marlowe, she was able to get the upper hand in the exchange with the Blade Runner more than once, and she even escaped. This was, of course, because Neander Jr. Programmed her to be a high-class fighter who couldn't easily be killed.
Yeah, I think by replicant they mean that Elle broke free from the programming that prevented her from harming a human. Her mind no longer functions in the same way as a typical replicant. But if you look at the clues, I think it's very clear that Elle is designed by Neander Jr. to do exactly what she does in these episodes. She's a replicant who was specially designed and built to be an assassin. She is the bad angel that Jr. refers to in 2049, and perhaps in his eyes, she's the angel of death. That is why she broke free of her conditioning the way that she did. This is why she has insane combat skills to the point where she could fight an elite Brave Runner and hold him to a draw. Also, as an aside, I got major Punisher vibes from Marlowe, but maybe that's just me. And it's definitely why Elle was able to access the handprint ID. Neander Jr. designed her to be his father's killer, and given how deadly Elle is in this show, he clearly did a thorough job of it. More than that, she's plausibly deniable, just a case of his father's sporting games gone wrong. Once the job is done, he can quietly have her retired with no one the wiser. It's a great plan, and he gets exactly what he wants from her.
Yeah. You know, and you're not alone. The Punisher vibes for Marlowe are definitely not just you. I picked up on that as well. It really was brilliant, a really brilliant plan on Neander Jr.'s part. And the writing, it's just brilliant on this series. In fact, I'm thinking about picking it up as it fits very nicely into this franchise. But before we wrap up, I want to talk about the live-action Blade Runner series that's coming to Amazon Prime. It has been kind of a long journey getting around to that point. The new series' path to the small screen has been driven chiefly by Ridley Scott himself, and it also started back in the promotional tour of the 2015 film The Martian. While on that tour, Ridley Scott expressed interest in making additional Blade Runner films. Then 2 years later, in 2017, when Blade Runner 2049 came out, director Denis Villeneuve said that he had expected a third film would be made if 2049 was successful, and it was. Hampton Fancher, who wrote both films, added that he was considering reviving an old story idea about Deckard traveling to another country, and Harrison Ford said that he would be open to returning if he liked the script. 1 year later, in January 2018, Ridley Scott said this about a third film, that he had another story ready to evolve and be developed, and that there is certainly one to be done for sure. Then, ever inching forward with ideas, Denis Villeneuve expressed interest in revisiting the Blade Runner universe in a different way, making something disconnected from both other movies, as opposed to a direct sequel in January 2020. Finally, in November of 2021, Ridley Scott announced that a Blade Runner TV series was in the works by February 2022, it was announced that the series Blade Runner 2099 was in development at Amazon Studios. It will be set 50 years after the events of 2049. Scott will serve as an executive producer and potentially direct at least some of the series, while Silke Louisa from The Wildling, Strange Angel, Shining Girls will also serve as the series showrunner.
Every time I see something set in 2099, I expect Spider-Man 2099 to show up. Although Miguel O'Hara would fit in really well with the Blade Runner universe. But seriously, I guess we'll see what happens with this. I mean, it sounds like there are some talented people with different visions of which way Blade Runner should go. I don't know who Silka Luisa is or any of the shows she's done, so I can't really comment on her involvement. But then I didn't know who Denis Villeneuve was before 2049 came out, so I could be pleasantly surprised. And Blade Runner has been such a consistent franchise up to this point that I'm hopeful for that 2099 will keep building on that.
Currently, 2099 is staffing up its writer's room, so it's not really very far along yet. Blade Runner 2049 co-writer Michael Green is among the series' numerous producers. Blade Runner 2049 will be the first live-action series in the franchise. There's no word of when Blade Runner 2099 will premiere, or what it will ultimately be about, but it will likely be a bit of a wait since production has not even begun.
Yeah, with Ridley Scott and one of 2049's co-writers involved, that may be hopefully be enough to keep the new series consistent with what's come before, but it's still pretty early in the process, so there are many ways that this can go still.
I have similar faith in the new movie. I know it'll be good because Scott and Michael Green are working on it, and they did so well before. But I gotta say, man, I owe you for turning me on to this franchise, Steve. It really is a good one. But that about wraps up our discussion on the franchise and our celebration of Blade Runner's 40th anniversary. I want to take this moment to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.